Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Tom Steemstra's Sierra Crossing. And as you know, Tom has received the 2017 Emmy Award winner. So we introduce Tom and we welcome him, and we're always happy to see Tom to tell us about all that he does.
How y'all doing? It's good to see you. Is this hearing working out okay?
Yes.
Cool. We're going to have some fun tonight. I know that you all could have been at the Eagles concert just down the street at the baseball park, but just so you know, we sold out before they did. Okay, they have a little few more seats than us. A reader sent in that he figured out that I had hiked 45,000 miles, and he wanted to know, of all that country we've seen, what's your favorite? And that's what this show's about. This is about my favorite hike anywhere in the world, and it's a hike that any of you can do too, and I'll tell you how you can do that. And this is my buddy. That's Mike, right? You took that? That's my buddy Mike. He's looking down into the Kern Canyon and the Great Western Divide. Anyway, the best hike, in my opinion, it has everything. It has incredible natural beauty, history, and it has the power of place, and that's what puts me there. And that's, I swear I'm hitting it. Yeah, I don't know, which is the button here, the arrow? Okay. Anyway, where you start is at the foot of Mount Whitney in Lone Pine. And the idea is, if you were a pioneer coming across the Great Basin, and you came up on the Sierra Crest, and you wanted to get to the San Joaquin Valley over the other side, what would you say? Just like the pioneers, let's go back to St. Louis. Well, this is our route, and it's only 70 miles. And 70 miles puts it within range of anybody to do in a week. That's only an average of 10 miles a day. So the first time I did this trip, we had our expedition team was the original Ram Bob. And that's my brother Bob, who made it here tonight, which is cool. And my other pal, Mike Furness. And now, my brother had a real unusual childhood. He was actually raised by a bear family. And as he grew older, he was very confused as a child. Later in life, we hiked the John Muir Trail. The first time was in 85, 86. And that's us. You can see the picture on the left. It looks like we're floating on the trail together. The one on the right, we're crossing the ice cut below Forrester Pass. And then we made it up Forrester. And the reason I stuck this in is we ran into Brian Robinson up there that day. He became America's first Triple Crown hiker and hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, Continental Divide Trail, and Appalachian Trail in the same year. I actually did it in 10 months. And just after this point, I broke my ankle. And I had been well-funded to do this trip and write a eight-part series. And so I had to keep going. And so what ended up happening is my pack kept getting lighter and lighter and lighter. And at the end of 3 weeks, there was almost nothing in it. And you know why? Because along the way, old Ram Bob was taking stuff out of my pack and carrying it out. And that's how he got his nickname. Now, Bob is known for holding up my fish. Like this big rainbow he caught on my rod. No, he's got the lucky star over him when it comes to catching fish. But you got to remember, he had a very unusual childhood being raised by bears. And he has a thing about these little cubs because he identifies with them. Anyway, the last we saw, Bob was up in Alaska. It's the last known photo of Bob. We're going to miss him. Mike Furness is the other expedition team member on this first trip. And cool thing about Mike, he couldn't be here tonight. He's on his way to Norway today, where he is the world's really preeminent expert on reducing soil erosion and sedimentation of streams. And he's going to Norway to do a plan for that whole country. And then from there, he's going to Africa. I mean, what a life. His motto is live large. Think big and live large. And there's Mike wanting not to live as large, where he's hiking out of a lake, that's Vernon in northern Yosemite, on one of the trips we did. And I'd say between the three of us, we've probably hiked about 10,000 miles together. And Mike is mainly the photographer. Most of these pictures were taken by him, and I've learned a lot from him about how to do that. Now me, I just want to get out there. And the harder it is, the more I like it. It's like I had that broken ankle, and my brother said, "You just did that to make it more fun." But whether it's crossing a stream or being up in the high country for the first snow of the year, it's like it does feel like the marrow of life. The only difference between hardship and adventure really is your spirit. I mean, would you rather wake up to that or the traffic out there? I mean, man. So the last time I was here, I did a show where we hiked from Tuolumne Meadows up to that glacier right below Mount Lyell and climbed the glacier, and did a week-long expedition up there. And then we went up, and inside the glacier, we rappelled up onto the glacier and found a hollowed-out spot. Went inside it and actually caught the first drop of melting water off of that glacier and drank it. And then we followed that water all the way down the Tuolumne River to the Golden Gate Bridge. And then we did a PBS special on it. And guess what? We won the Emmy. Unbelievable. Couldn't believe it. We were good. The other final was a special, a national special on breast cancer recovery. And the category was science, health, and environment. And my wife looked at me and said, "I'm sorry, honey, I don't think you're going to win." And I said, "I know, that's okay." So we're ready to go hiking now. And we'll start at Lone Pine. Oh, I almost forgot the best thing about this. You got to pass it on down. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to be there and do all these different trips with youngsters or your kids. This is my son Jeremy on his first trip on the John Muir Trail. And you'd think after I taught him everything I could think of that he'd want to go with me. No. He wants to prove to you that he can do it on his own. What our job is to expose this world to him. And so guess what he did last year? He hiked the whole Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada. And then he said, "I don't think you've done that, Tom." Hey, next year, he came over last week, and he's mapping out hiking the Continental Divide Trail next year, 3,400 miles. So we're going to start in the town of Lone Pine on the eastern side of the Sierra, and that's actually from our hotel room. We're looking at the eastern Sierra crest there, and one of those peaks is Mount Whitney. Any idea which one it is? Because in Lone Pine, all the tourists pick that big one on the left. No, it's that one in the center right. There it is, that one on the center right. And that kind of defines the trip in a way, because if you were a pioneer coming across east to west and saw something like that, you go, "How do we get around that thing?" And you know what? That's what we're going to do. We're going to walk in the footsteps of the pioneers, guys like Joe Walker, John Muir, Captain John Fremont, and Ed Kern. So we drive up in the morning, and what I did, I hired a guy from Sequoia National Park, and he drove our crew from Sequoia at the end of the trail all the way to Lone Pine. And so my truck was waiting for us at the end of the trail. So that makes it 70 miles. And so we start, instead of hiking from Whitney Portal, which is, it starts with a 6,000-foot gain from 8,000 to 14,000 to the Whitney Summit. Instead, there's a whole nother way to do it. I mean, I've done that hike, but there's another way to do it. And that is you go up to the Alabama Hills, and that's where they filmed all of these episodes from movies and televisions, Star Trek, Half Gun Will Travel. I'm sure you just watch some of those old films, and you'll see the scenery behind them. So the reason this is such a great trailhead at Horseshoe Meadows, the elevation is 9,980 feet. Almost a 10,000-foot jump-off spot. So instead of having to start the trip by climbing 4,000 or 5,000 feet from the bottom of a canyon someplace, instead, it's just 1,200 feet. It starts off a little bit sandy in the conifer zone, and it rises quickly into the rock area and climbs about 1,200 feet. And you reach, it climbs quickly to tree line, and then emerges on top at Cottonwood Pass. And that's at about 11,200 feet. I think it's 11,180. And then from Cottonwood Pass, you pop out and you look over the other side, and that's Big Whitney Meadow. I've spent a week in there just because I wanted to see everything. And that meadow is filled with all these little streams called stringers. They're small creeks that cut away the meadows. It leaves cut bank, and it's full of the last pure strain of golden trout in the world, right there in that valley. On the far side of it, it drops down into that canyon and goes down left and goes down to the Kern Canyon. That's one way to do it. Instead, we turned right on the Pacific Crest Trail, and we went by Chicken Spring Lake, and on our left is called the Siberian Outpost. It's so remote that for miles and miles, there's nobody. It's incredible when you think just outside the door here between Sacramento and the Bay Area, there's over 10 million people. And we're going about the same distance, and there might be 100 people out there. So what if you're not feeling all that comfortable about hiking above 10,000 feet? Well, we met somebody who didn't want to do that and somebody who didn't want to have to carry any gear. Jesus. And there we go. Ran into Grace Lohr, Amazing Grace. She's out of Bishop, California. And that's what she does. She looked at me. She goes, man, you're working way too hard carrying all that stuff. I just put my gear on my llamas. Let them do all the work. Their names are Otis the Elevator, because he can climb so good, and the other one's Osama bin Llama. She's amazing, very inspirational. And if you think, hey, I don't want to have to carry all my stuff and hike for a week, but I want to see this country, well, there's other ways to do it. You can have a llama carry it. You can have a goat carry it. Have a mule carry it. Have a horse carry it. Or get on the horse and have the horse carry you. But there's many paths to do this. And it doesn't matter your age, whether you're in your 80s like Grace or these young women we met at the foot of the head of the Rock Creek Basin. And they were on their very first trip, and they were looking for the lake and had no idea where it was. Having the time of their lives. And so my friend Mike helped them. They were very worried about this perilous creek crossing. You can see the concern. I mean, this is serious business. But they ended up having just as much fun as anybody would have. You end up at one of the Soldier Lakes, this incredible place to camp the first night. And for years, we've had this joke that we're going to hike for 50 miles into the middle of nowhere. And then here comes the Swedish bikini team. And they looked over at us and said, would you mind if we went swimming? And Bob goes, no, I think that's okay. Mike goes, no, no problem. They're wearing bathing suits. It was really fun, though. And they were having a good time. And, you know, they're all, Mike has kept track of them. They've all grown up to have families with kids, and they're sharing the outdoors too. And a lot of it is the imprinting they have from this experience out in the middle of the wilderness. And this is the picture they ran in the Chronicle of it. I like throwing this in because I got letters after they ran this. They go, look at the looks in your faces. Obviously, that was a very easy trip. No, they had just jumped in the lake. So that was our first day's camp. What a great first day, you know? We wake up the next day. We go back down. I check the map off. We're at a little spur. And at just a few miles back down to the Pacific Crest Trail, on the way down, the Rock Creek drainage, you go by this little unknown, unnamed lake. And as we went by, you can see, first off, how all lakes become meadows. And all meadows were once lakes. And eventually they fill in from sedimentation, from the flow of water through them. And as we were walking by, we stopped for a second because it was totally quiet except for all these little pop sounds. And it was the sounds of fish feeding. Remember that? Just pop, pop, pop. It was just incredible. You know, an unrepeatable moment. And the trail goes down and hooks up with the Pacific Crest Trail, where we ran into this wilderness ranger, Allison Steiner from UC Davis. And she's about 6 feet tall. She's checking our wilderness permit, and you can see that she has a Sierra cup right on her hip there. And I asked her, I said, you know, I used to do that, but since we have to filter all of our water, I stopped carrying mine on my hip. And she goes, not me. I've spent 6 years back here, and I've never had to filter my water. That's how pristine this area is. If you can, you know, it's really a defining moment. As we head north on the Sierra Crest, you go over Guyo Pass, and then you settle down towards Crabtree Meadow, which is a major intersection with the John Muir Trail. And you're looking at the Sierra Crest there right off to your right. And as you descend down that rockfall, the trail switched back right down to the meadow. You can see Mount Whitney back there, and you realize in 2 days you've gone from one side of Whitney to the other. Just 1.5 days, really. Incredible. And you come down and set up your camp. And Whitney and what it represents really comes into focus. You know, it was named after Josiah Whitney, who was part of the famous Brewer Expedition from around 1864. Brewer, Whitney, and two other great guys that traveled the entire state by foot, horseback, and boat, and then did a geological essay that chronicled everything in California. That book has been, that diary of that expedition has been reprinted by UC Berkeley, and it's an incredible time machine to read. That's Crabtree Meadow, and there's Whitney in the back. It's a beautiful, pristine place. So it's a popular camp. And if you want to take a side trip, it's like about 9 miles from here up to Mount Whitney. Here's a picture of the first time I summited it. And the reason I stuck this in is we put a black and white picture in because it is like going back in time. You figure it's really likely John Muir sat on that rock. It's really likely Josiah Whitney was right there too. I mean, and it really does put things in perspective. So we wake up from Crabtree, and this is a major junction. And you can see it's 8.7 to Whitney from there. We're going to Wallace Creek. So we're going to be on the John Muir Trail and Pacific Crest Trail for just 4 miles. And what happens, this section of trail is pretty busy. The John Muir Trail is one of the most popular trails. 95% of the wilderness permits out of Whitney Portal or out of Yosemite are turned down. So other people will come in on these side routes to avoid those major trail endpoints and still get in there. So the one thing you do find is everybody is happy. I mean, people ask me, do you ever feel afraid or in danger? No. We meet a lot. My wife and me have been hiking a lot where we've run into countless solo women hikers, or a pair, like in their 60s, 70s, and they just don't want things to pass by where they don't get to see these places and experience them. What you don't see is you don't see a lot of young men. Man, are they missing the boat. So you turn left at Wallace Creek, and from the John Muir Trail, you descend down into the Kern Canyon. And it's a long day, but it's mostly downhill. And all the way down the canyon, you have all these side feeder creeks all the way down, so there's plenty of water most of the route down. And so you stop to have lunch, stop to get water, stop to soak your feet, Bob. Now, what he's just smart there, he's pumping water and stuck his feet in while he's doing it. And as you get down towards the canyon, the Great Western Divide starts coming into view. And then you come around this point, and it's the anticipation of what this means is just amazing. You come to this point and a little bit beyond, and you're going, wow, I'm going to drop to the bottom of that and then go over the other side. And on this point, what we're looking at is the headwaters of the Kern River that come out of Kings Canyon National Park above treeline. And in late spring, all the way down that canyon, it's a cataract of waterfalls, especially the big snow years. And you turn and look the other way, and it's a sea of conifers all the way out to the San Joaquin Valley. And from the San Joaquin Valley to the headwaters, it's 80 miles. You can start walking at the forks of the Kern and go 65 miles on a trail all the way up and back. You could do a 130-mile trip that's fairly easy and have the river next to you the whole way. It's incredibly beautiful. And you drop down into forest near the river, and you get this incredible first glimpse. And I have to tell you, when you see something like this, it's about as close as it gets to falling in love. I mean, when I see this, it reminds me of the inflections I watch on my wife's face and how they make me feel when I watch this, when I think of this river. It's just incredible. What a place. So that's our first night's camp there. And we're halfway through.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Tom Steemster's Sierra Crossing. Tom, as we know, is the 2017 Emmy Award winner. And I want you to know that this is the first time, and I've known Tom for a while, that I have ever, ever seen him in a tuxedo. And he looked gorgeous. So back to you, Tom.
They put me up at the hotel, what was that, the Fairmont? No, remember that? I have to tell you, they were so worried I wasn't going to show up that they picked us up in a limo. To get to that spot, from where we went, was 32 miles in 2 days. Most of it was downhill, though. Okay, now that's the most ambitious part of the trip, is 32 miles in 2 days. From the other areas, it's even farther. If you start at the Forks of the Kern, it's 42.8 miles from the Forks of the Kern, where the ranger station is, to Junction Meadow, where we ended up. Imagine that. That's why you don't see anybody in there. And as you look down from that point, you can see why I called it the cradle of the Sierra, because it's nestled between the Sierra Crest on one side and the Great Western Divide on the other. I mean, there's no place else like it in the world. It's incredible. Now, the history of this canyon is, to me, is so special. One of my heroes is Joe Walker. He's the guy, the first guy to discover, first trailblazer to see Yosemite in 1833, what, November 13th? And anyway, he was camping in 1844. He was actually at Walker Lake in Nevada that was named after him. He went over Walker Pass, which is south of the Dome Land Wilderness, and then camped here at the Forks of the Kern, And they were his troop was being called back to the San Joaquin Valley by John C. Fremont. And his topographer, Ed Kern, took some time off while they were camped at the Forks and went up the Kern River and was the first trailblazer to see all this stuff. And that's why John Fremont named it the Kern River. And you can go to and see Joe Walker's gravesite above Martinez in the Alhambra Cemetery. And to stand there and be with my hero like this, it's just an incredible moment. And probably the greatest trailblazer of them all. And even though he didn't bring he didn't write about his trip, so people tend not to know him. And then Ed Kern was the guy, a topographer. He died in his 40s, but he was the first one to ever see this country. And so we set our trip up so we could take our time. By doing 16 miles in 2 days, we could take our time in the canyon and really see it and fish it. Our first time fishing, I think in my first 11 casts, I caught 7 fish. And the other 4 casts, I think I had maybe 12 strikes, and I didn't catch them. And it was like, what happened is my brother's going, I got one! And I go, yeah, big deal. No. No, it was just so amazing. You're talking about fish that have never been fished for. We catch and release about 90% of the time. But in this case, we just couldn't help it. That frying pan is about 24 inches around. And my brother always brings it on our trips because he likes frying them in butter. But Mike Furness and me, what we do is we put Lori season salt on them and put them right in the coals. And it's like barbecuing them. It's incredible. You think the fish are going to get burned up in the ash or something? No. And it's just amazing. It tastes so good. And but what happened, there comes a time when you've caught enough fish. And what you start doing is we would pick spots out on the along the river and just watch the fish work. At one point, my brother looked down and saw probably, I think he said it was like 18 to 20 inch rainbow that was just coming out, working, grabbing a bug, going back. You know what? He could have gone down there and caught that fish, but it's more special that he didn't. It's like we know it's there. It's like our little secret. And there's something special about that when you know you could do it. But to leave it alone sometimes is magic. Now, we were looking through all of our pictures, and we like, what is this? We have this thing where we all bring one bonus item on every trip. It turned out the bonus item for my brother was his frog, and he carried it the whole week. And he took a picture of it one day without us knowing. But I put it in the show because you have to bring bear-proof food canisters in this country. And it's really worked because we didn't see any bears because there was no food to get. All the bears are back at the drive-in campgrounds where they just go from picnic site to picnic site. And the bears just walk right in and everybody screams and they go through the picnic site, grab all the chicken. What they really like is the Swiss Miss and the Tang. But the point is, you don't let the bears get your stuff. They don't bother you. They move on. They might cruise through and just move right off. And now we end up sleeping through if they do come through. There's nothing to be afraid of, that's for sure. A lot of people ask what we do for water treatment. Just like you have to have canisters for the bear food, we use what's called a Steripen for our water purification because the water pumps can choke up, clog up, and get really heavy, and then don't work very well. The Steripen is an ultraviolet light. You put it in like a large Nalgene bottle. You put it in the stream, and in a minute and a half, you're drinking ice cold pure water. I mean, it's incredible, and that's probably the best invention in years. Walking through the Kern Canyon is like a step back in time through these giant fern groves. And as you go through these areas, you really start to feel like you know what? I am walking in the footsteps of Muir. I am in the same place that Ed Kern was, except he didn't have a hot tub. Years before the Wilderness Act was passed in 64, trailblazing hikers went in and found a hot spring right along the Kern. It's about 7 miles downstream of Funston Meadow, or of the trail junction there, the head of the river. And it's so hot that there's a scoop there to put river water into this tub. And there's Mike hard at work on the trail. This is the river from the top all the way down. We only saw a couple of people in 3 days, just taking our time, enjoying the beauty, soaking it up, just being in the footsteps of legends. And best of all, you're in a place that does. It feels like an outdoor church to us. And when you're in traffic and in congestion and you're trying to find a parking spot, and you know that there are still places like this out there, you keep that in the back of your mind, and it's a saving place. So we were heading down. We spent 3 days in the canyon, and we crossed the river, went through this big rock fall. The trail is not too hard to pass there. Fuel, we call those Ansel Adams cumulus clouds. Just everything just so beautiful. And our last campsite is down at the meadow. And it's funny, we got kind of sad and melancholy because we didn't want to leave. It's funny, I've been with groups and a couple times did guided trips where when people got near the end, they got all happy. They could hardly wait to check their phones. Remember that one trip that we did out of Yosemite? Yeah, we led this one trip from... we went over Vogelsang Pass, went up the backside of Half Dome, and then out the canyon. And most of the trip, they weren't all that happy about it. And then when we got about 2 miles from the parking lot, geez, it was like, yeah, baby, give me my phone. No, we want to go places where phones don't work. And so that night, Mike was really upset. He did not want to leave and go back to his life and working in the government at that time. And so we had our last campfire and said, well, all the good stuff is over. We were looking at to get out of that canyon, climbing from about 6,000 feet to 11,000 foot pass at Franklin Pass. So we're looking at a 5,000 foot climb over 12 miles. And so we started out the next day, and you'd think with that kind of climb, we'd get out of our sleeping bags right away, right? And get on the trail and catch it when it's, you know, at dawn. No, we just laid in our sleeping bags and we were listening to the birds. It was an unbelievable symphony of birds. And we always get up. And then Bob said, do you hear that? And Mike says, oh, yeah, listen to them. They're talking. And it was there for at least a half hour. We just absorbed this moment of the birds talking in Funston Meadow. And then we finally decided we got to do this. It's 5,000 feet ahead of us. But then a funny thing happened. You can see the sign there. It's 10.6 miles to Franklin Pass.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
We started up the canyon, and it's switchbacked, so you can get into a rhythm rather than just a goat trail going straight up. And we start getting these incredible canyon views again. It's like, wow. That's a Kagupa Mount, Kagupa Rock, and that's the, one of the last pieces of the canyon you see before you cross through and start rising up. And instead of just having to do this endless climb kind of march, instead, it's kind of like the trail over at Wilder Ranch State Park near Santa Cruz on the coast, where the hillside is terraced all the way up from being under the ocean at some point. And that's how it is here. So you get these flat spots all the way up, so you get these breaks. So you have short climbs and then terraces and little side spurs down to the river. And again, you could just drink that water right out of the river. It's incredible. And it's like, man, this is where I want to live. But that trail goes up on these terraces, and they're full of wildlife. And it's so different than what we expected. We expected a long, grueling, sun-exposed march to a bear pass. Instead, every step was great all the way up. And we took a spur over to Forester Lake. And this is one of the prettiest lakes you've ever seen in your life. And guess how many other people were there? Zero. How can this be in California with 40 million people? There wasn't anybody. And this is a cool picture because the sky, this happens in the fall often. It also often happens in summer in the Southern Sierra, where you'll get cut off lows from typhoons that break apart and sweep up with the monsoonal moisture that goes up the Southern Sierra. And so you get all these different cloud types, Alto Cirrus and Mare's Tails, and there's Alto Stratus and a partial cumulus. And it changes every 5 minutes. The next day we woke up and you could see those pools, the fish were just jumping all over the place. But this is our last day. So we actually turned our back on our fishing rods and started heading out to Franklin Pass, about 11,000 feet. And there, if you look at this picture closely, you'll see my brother hiking. And it gives you an idea, the perspective of the scope, of the huge grandeur of this granite beauty. I mean, look at that. It's gigantic. And on the way up, he met several of his marmot family members going up. Made him very happy. And then, like a lot of summits, Glen Pass is this way, Taboose Pass. You keep thinking, the next curve and I'm there. No, you're not, no. I'm trying to think of some of the worst ones, but Glen Pass is a real fooler. Forester Pass kind of does that in the beginning. Yeah. Muir Pass goes on forever. That's an all day. But is that it? No, that's not it. It looks like it. Is that it? No. This has got to be it. You just keep doing this for about an hour and a half. You think you're almost there. Hey, it's just around the bend. Hey, it's just around the bend. It's got to be there. And then finally, it is around the bend. And you pop out on top of Franklin Pass. And on the other side is Sequoia National Park in the San Joaquin Valley and the Sierra foothills. And then the best part is you turn the other way and you look across all the country you just walked over. And if you look on the top, you'll see Mount Whitney over there. It's not the big one on the left. It fools everybody, but Mount Whitney, Langley on the Muir, and then north, it's just a stegosaurus rim of peaks. It's incredible. And the Kern Canyon is that big gash right in the middle there. Just an amazing experience and a 360 to see this. Then looking the other way, you're looking down for a glimpse of Franklin Lake and beyond. You can see across the San Joaquin Valley. There's a little haze layer when we hit it, but it's still really dramatic. And the trail, you're still well above tree line. And you can see how the trail just kind of cuts into that escarpment there. And actually, this is the most dangerous part of the trip. you got to pay attention to every step, because this is where if you fall, gravity definitely wins. Down at the bottom there, though, the ground will break your fall. So that's comforting. And yet, and by now, you're a week in. I mean, you're feeling really strong. You're totally acclimated to being up at 10,000 feet. You know, you've been eating fish for the last 3 days in the river. You're feeling really good. So you can make pretty good time going downhill here. You have to be careful not to, to stay in rhythm and not make any bad steps. And it works around past the Franklin Lakes. And it does this until you finally get down back into vegetation. And then even then, every single crevice and canyon and side current has water coming down it. And it's like you're 5-6 miles from the truck now, and you're thinking, oh, all the good stuff is done. But it's not, because the water is just amazing. And it's just, it gives you one last place where you just want to stop and enjoy it and drink it. There's a natural spring we found that my brother's filling up his canteen. And just sensational. You start getting back into the real old trees. And you wonder if Ed Kern may have walked past that tree, or maybe Joe Walker did at some point, or maybe John Muir. And then as you descend and there becomes more soil, that's when the wildflowers start picking up. You know, there'll be wildflowers all through summer, into fall even. You come around a bend. This is called Farewell Canyon, and it's the end of the trip. We're parked right at the foot of that canyon right there. And what you just did was only 70 miles. That may sound like a lot of walking. It's not. That's 10 miles a day. 10 miles a day is not a tremendous amount. And if you don't want to carry your gear, you don't have to. Just remember Amazing Grace. Or the young women in their trip. They didn't like carrying a lot of weight. They went in real light. But if I had to think of one place that I'd want to go, it's this. This is the place that where you can have what feels like unrepeatable moments, but you can repeat the adventure. It's probably my favorite hike in the world. It's just incredible to hike from Mount Whitney to the San Joaquin Valley, just like the pioneers, like Joe Walker and Ed Kern, John Fremont, the great ones. Now, I did a little ebook. You can buy it for like $5 through Amazon if you want to see what I wrote about this trip with Mike's pictures. And then here's a little promotion on my books. The hiking book this year has been the number one travel book in San Diego, Santa Barbara, and Sacramento. And that's kind of like being the best second baseman in Iceland. The camping book is the world's number one selling outdoor book. And the reason is real simple. If you don't have it and you're out there and you don't have a place to go that night, or where you thought you were going to go is full, kind of like the Larkspur parking lot in the ferry tonight, you're screwed. My book will be your safety valve. It'll be your net. And so you'll never get stuck. And that's why it works. I got those two other books. Pacific Northwest Camping, that was a number one bestseller in Portland against all the mystery novels and John Grisham and all that stuff, which is cool. And we just came out with a new edition of West Coast RV, which is California, Oregon, and Washington. And then I wrote a novel a couple years ago because I just wanted to see if I could do it. And I sat down with four homicide inspectors, and I told them I had this plan for a murder. And I wanted them to tell me how they'd catch me, and then that would be my detective line. And they listened to my plot. I had two homicide inspectors from San Francisco and two from San Mateo County, and the DA from San Mateo County, Al Giannini. And Al looked at me, he looked at the four homicide inspectors, and he goes, "We'd never get you, Tom." So we had to put clues in to give them a chance. Yeah, it was really fun. Yeah, I wrote that book, and then I sent it to my mentor and muse. My mentor is John Lacroix, the great novelist, and my muse is Steve Griffin in Michigan. And Steve met me in Louisiana and said, your first draft is good. We're going to change a few things. And I go, what's that? And he goes, well, first we're going to change who did it. This is what your friends are for. Now, when you're a writer, it doesn't bother you. You just write. I wrote another 400 pages. It's just, it's what you do. But I love this picture because it's it says everything about the outdoors. You know, it's got it all there. You know, looking down into Yosemite, in the side of Half Dome there, and Nevada Fall, Vernal. Just incredible, Liberty. I mean, this, what a place and what an experience. You know, if there's anything to remember, what the most important thing is not what you achieve, you know, that I did this peak or I caught this big fish or I grew up with a marmot. No, it's all about how does it make you feel inside? That's it. How does it make you feel inside? That's why I do it. And I tell you what, it makes me feel alive. It makes me feel like this is what I'm meant to be. This is my purpose in life, to be these places. I just got a call a little while ago. It looks like the Chronicle is going to start moving a lot of my stories into the travel section on Sundays. And they thought I might get upset. You know, I'm still going to be in on Mondays and Thursdays. And they're saying, in sports, and they're saying, we're thinking we could bring a lot of readers into that travel section and try to make it more outdoors, adventure-oriented. And they said, plus, instead of your picture, we'll use a drawing of you. They're like, oh, wow, what a selling point. Anyway, thank you very much for coming. And I'm happy to answer any question about anything. I mean, I'm really literally an open book and transparent.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Tom Steemstra, Sierra Crossing, 2017 Emmy Award winner. And we do have some questions for you, Tom. The first one, which I think is really interesting, and I think we are all concerned about it. You've been hiking, this is the question. You've been hiking the Sierras for years. Thinking of the effects of climate change, what are some of the greatest, the worst, the best changes you have experienced?
That's a really good question, and you should see my TV show. That was the point of our show, the Mighty T, the Tuolumne River, because when we climbed up to Mount Lyell, the Lyell Glacier was 90% gone. And it was incredible because we had pictures from the 1890s. And the reason those pictures were taken is because John Muir went up there in the early 1880s. And that's where he did his very first glacier studies to prove that glaciers move and are living things. And that's how he ended up beating Josiah Whitney in that argument. Because Josiah Whitney thought that the Sierra was created from earthquakes, where he had correctly figured that out. That's how Lake Tahoe was created, from a massive earthquake where a huge fault dropped. So he thought that's how the Sierra was, and John Muir saying, oh, no, 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 no. And Josiah Whitney called him an old sheep herder. John Muir said, yeah, well, I went to the University of Nature. So they got into that. But so that glacier has melted off, and we have been able to verify it for 135 years. I mean, the other thing we see is because the winters are different. We have a lot more rain, and the snow level tends to be lower. And so what happens is you have a band of pine trees mainly from about what used to be the snow line, about 4,700 to about 6,400 in there. And because of the lack of snow in that zone, because the snow has been higher than that, they get dry in the summer. And so they get vulnerable to beetle death, beetle encroachment. And so vast swaths of forests in that elevation zone have died. And to see that, if you were to fly over it, it's stunning. The amount of dead trees in that zone. Now, once you get above the pine zone and into where the cedars are, it's fine. The other thing you see is you see a translocation of wildlife and birds. You see everything is higher than it used to be. And in a lot of areas, it's like you see it over and over. Where we used to get snow, the snow is like 1,000 feet higher than that now. And the effect in California in terms of how it affects the urban populations is really significant because we get a third of our water from snowpack. And so if the snowpack isn't there, we got a problem. So that ends up being I know what the solution is, though, for that. And that's what my next project is. All we have to do is put rain catchment systems on our roofs, and each person can provide water for themselves. And there's no reason to have to divert it from other areas. The only place that doesn't work is where there's vertical populations, you know, like in high rises. But the way urban sprawl is, every house could have their own water catchment system, and there'd be no need to divert water from one area to another, which is inherently problematic in years with low water and low snowpacks.
Second question. Have the large forest fires we've had the past few years reflected... your hikes much?
That's a good question. I just had this discussion with my editor, my books, 2 days ago, because we're redoing California Camping right now. And the answer is, not really. The biggest problem has been smoke, breathing the smoke. And you want to get away from that. It's terrible. And the ash, it's just terrible. There are areas in Northern California this year. Well, between the fire at Clear Lake and the four fires in the North State, it's like 650,000 acres. It's incredible. But the wilderness areas, a lot of them don't have very much fuel. And a lot of the best areas are above tree line. You know, when you do the John Muir Trail, you're above 10,000 feet for a long time at the south end. I mean, maybe 10 days, you know. Maybe you drop down a couple days. There isn't that much fuel up there. And it doesn't really affect the campgrounds either that you can drive to, because the way they fight the forest fires now has changed. What they do is they direct the fires. They don't necessarily try to put them out right away. They direct them. And they can be late getting on top of a fire. And when that happens, they can't put it out. So what they do is they find these forest roads, and the crews will go in, and they'll cut down all the trees along that road. And then they'll bring in these bulldozers and create about a 50-yard-wide swath fire break. Then they go on the other side of it, wait till the conditions are right, and we'll start a whole series of fires on the other side and burn into the fire. And that's how they are able to protect structures, and that's how they create containment lines. But on the other side, it ends up creating these massive amounts of acres burned in areas that are unroaded. A lot of them are in national forests, not wilderness, where there's really not a lot of trails or lakes or high recreational value. And so it's kind of like this double-edged sword. The acres burned is really high, but the recreational resources have largely been protected.
One of our audience members says, as I recall, Kit Carson led the first incursion into California. There are two questions. How did his route compare to yours? His observation was a very smoky one in the San Joaquin Valley. What was that observation?
Yeah. The early trailblazers were Kit Carson, Jedediah Smith, and Joe Walker. Those are the three big guys. And the way that they came in, for the most part, was across the Great Basin in the desert, and they came in from the south. They didn't go through the Sierra. It wasn't until Joe Walker made that first trip in over Yosemite. We think, I've tried to trace his route, and we think he went through Virginia Lakes and dropped in the backside of Yosemite, that anybody tried to go over the Sierra. And those guys, see, were mainly looking for beaver. And that's why they went into the San Joaquin Valley, is they were going into virgin grounds to trap beaver. And Jedediah Smith, for instance, was actually arrested for trespassing by the Mexican government and was told to leave California. And he said he would. Instead, he went, of course, exactly the opposite direction and went up to Northern California and northwest, southwestern Oregon. And that's why so many things are named Smith up there. And then he got arrested again. But Kit Carson was a guide for John Fremont. That's probably his number one thing. John Fremont is probably the most famous of the explorers, but he was like a politician. He loved being out, but he would have Kit Carson guide him. And then he had his own biographer with him that was sending stories back to the East Coast newspapers to be famous. And that so many things are named Fremont because of that. I mean, the story that I heard from a historian that when we took California as our own state and won that war, the Bear Flag Revolt, John Fremont was waiting with his battalion at the Oregon border, ready to come down and declare victory. It took him 3 days because he went in a circle, got lost. He didn't have Kit Carson with him. He got to Eureka and goes, "We did it!" Like, hey man, that was like 3 days ago.
We've come to that part of our program tonight that we have one last question. Question is, in your opinion, what is one action item that we can do to preserve our wild places?
That's great, because I'm a real believer of that, of keeping things wild. And the most important thing you can do is share your love of it with somebody and show it to them so they love it too. When people love something, they step up to protect it. When they don't love something, it isn't that they hate it. They just don't care. And they don't do anything. And that's the difference. I mean, I've seen how people in my community have taken areas that have needed protecting, and it's because they love it. You know, there's some people that say, no, we have to keep it a secret. We can't let anybody know about it. No, you know what? We have 40 million people here. It's way too late for that. Everybody knows every place, just about. I mean, but if you teach somebody to love something, they'll wake up wanting to protect it.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Tom Steemstra, Sierra Crossing. He is the 2017 Emmy Award winner. So for our audience, and I know how much we learned tonight and watched and heard and listened for what Tom gave us, let's give him a huge applause. And And for our audience, thanks to you for being a terrific audience here and on our radio and on the internet. So here's a big applause for all of us who are interested so much and dedicated to our environment. So let's give us applause. You can find our programs at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org for watch plus listen for programs, audio, videotapes, radio schedules, free weekly podcasts, and archives. And each of you, I hope, will take home a green sheet and come back and see our fall programs and talk with us and your concerns about what is happening with our environment today. And at this point in time, just to remind you that we will be here and here for you for the Environment and Natural Resources programs. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you to all of us who are listening on the radio and will be listening, and for you here in our audience tonight at the Commonwealth Club of California. And I hope you have taken a tour of our beautiful new building here at 110 Embarcadero. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.